Good to see everyone again. Thanks for coming tonight. This will be my third event on the theme of unmodernism, and the specific topic for tonight for this seminar is called The Forms of Theory. Just by way of brief recap, in the second event in the first seminar, in other words, we looked at the substance of thought. And I'm basically interested there in philosophical terms for what persists and what endures across time, and even really across change, whether it's some kind of accidental change or historical change. And what I tried to do there is to link political problems with philosophical concepts, broadly speaking. And that follows from the first event, which was the lecture on Hegel in the cathedral, where the cathedral was a site for the persistence of the Middle Ages on the one hand, but as well a space for modernization itself. Not in terms of renovation so much, though of course we know that that took place several decades after Hegel had died, but the kind of modernization that indicates the processes of urbanization. And Hegel looked within that space and saw something like urbanization, though in his peculiar phenomenological language. Okay. So the third thing then we're doing today is called the forms of theory. And the thing that persists here on the topic of unmodernism are genres. So these would be the forms. But I think first what I have to do is go through this idea of theory and perhaps defend why I'm calling this the forms of theory rather than something else, the forms of philosophy or what have you. So philosophy versus theory. This is a distinction I've made in other work trying to define what theory is as something besides anything goes, as something besides watered down philosophy according to the philosophers. And one of the points of distinction between philosophy and theory in my account is theory takes up not only, let's say, a philosophy of language, and I don't only mean that in the rigid sense that it's understood in, say, analytic philosophy around questions of reference and intention, but a philosophical or theoretical discourse that also takes in literary discourse and literary practices. In other words, a philosophical discourse that has a self-reflexivity about language and that understands that exposition is not transparent to philosophical concept, that to write is to think. Let's say in those broad terms. I have described the break of theory from philosophy in relationship to the move from Kant to Hegel. And here, I think, while you can say that, yes, Hegel deals with concepts, read the Phenomenology of Spirit, follow the movement of the grip or the concept, or read the Science of Logic and follow the multiple concepts there, while indeed Hegel does have conceptuality in his philosophical system, it's different from the Kantian conceptuality. And if you remember the handout that I gave you last time, there was the table of categories. That is what a rigid philosophical conceptuality looks like, to such an extent that what it gives you, that picture, that table of categories, is the transcendental subject. A set of categories that holds true for all individuals, every person sitting in this room, your mind operates along similar lines of conceptual synthesis in the table of categories. So then if we're looking at the question of language and philosophy, then I think there's something here too to be said about literariness. Now, when one mentions the term literariness, or just literature, let's say, you start to think about the problem of philosophy and literature, and this is nothing new. And we can cite the examples there. We have, well, we can go back to Plato, who wrote in the dialogue form, though then we also have what he says in the Republic about literature, if you remember the notorious claims there, that literature, like other kinds of art, is so much imitation of imitation. So literature doesn't quite do well in Plato's system, but then you can take it many centuries forward and go to Lucretius to find on the nature of things, on the property of things, and then find what there is a poem. Lucretius wrote that work as a poem, and then on to Kierkegaard's Seducer's Diary, at which point it seems that literature takes over philosophy. The circle, let's say, is complete, and then, of course, Sartre, who wrote plays, I think this is a different problem, or at least I'm trying to say that it's a different problem. I speak from the perspective of a medievalist who tries to be aware of the literary forms of the Middle Ages. I look at this problem as one where in the Middle Ages, literature and philosophy are coterminous, you could say. You could pick out various literary, and they're rhetorical problems too, but you could pick out various literary practices in the Middle Ages, such as the exemplary tradition, or exemplarity, or the example, or the exempla. And the question of exemplarity motivates a good deal of what I'm going to do here. So let me tell you a little something about Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. When you read the preface to the Critique of Pure Reason, you might breathe a sigh of relief, because it's there that Kant says, this work could have been twice the size, right? So in a printed edition, it comes in around 400, 500 pages. Oh, we can have 1,000 pages of this. Why do we not have 1,000 pages of this? Is because, as Kant tells us, he took out all the examples, which from my point of view is, you sort of took out the things that I want to read. It helps to have examples when reading Kant. Kant says that examples get in the way. Kant says that examples in concreto, uses that Latin phrase, interfere with the exposition, which obtains to a level of generality. So you can see that he's thinking here about the tension between philosophical thought on the one hand and exposition on the other, which then signals to someone that, well, perhaps examples are a kind of risk for Kant. Maybe he's really bad at them. Well, then, of course, that's not really very true. By the time we get to Kant of the critical period, the Kant of the Copernican Revolution, that is his critical philosophy, there was plenty of examples of Kant being quite literary. He has a very short treatise on the sublime, which is full of anecdotes and observation that I think could qualify as literature. As you move over the course of the three critiques, from the Critique of Pure Reason to the final one, to the Critique of Judgment, Kant really opens up, includes more examples, and you can see that there are consequences for his philosophical system. Things kind of change in the Kantian philosophy the more examples you put into it. And that's something I can go into in more detail later, but in Kant it is a very good example of the problem of philosophical thought on the one hand and exposition on the other. Now, I gave you the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals. Just needed just a little bit to make the point here. And the point here, Kant says, imitation of examples has no place at all in matters of morality. Nor could one give worse advice to morality than by wanting to derive it from examples. He calls popular morality a, quote, disgusting hodgepodge of patchwork observations. Okay, that's all good and fine, but then when you read the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals, what do you find? Well, you find examples. And you find the very things that people contest most about Kant. If you're going to pose problems to the Kantian moral philosophy, you look at his example of the shopkeeper and start to work with the example. And that's what examples expose the philosopher to, is, okay, well, what about this? What about a shopkeeper who gives discounts to his family members, which exhibits the inclination towards love? Isn't that okay? Why does love have to be in conflict with morality? Why does it have to derive from duty, as Kant says? Kant says examples are a problem, but then he gives us maxims. And you saw a maxim in your excerpt from the critique of, or from the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals, and the maxim goes as follows. I ought never to act except in such a way that I would or could also will that my maxim should become a universal law. That's the categorical imperative. I ought never to act except in such a way that I could also will that my maxim should become a universal law. And this is interesting that we have maxims. Maxims are all over early modern philosophy. They are also all over medieval philosophy. The uniqueness here of this maxim is that Kant is suggesting or proposing that you work like an author. Come up with your own maxim, then universalize it. We miss the crucial step of authoring the maxim. And then as we start to look around, we think about, you know, Erasmus's adages, place of maximic literature In the philosophical literary scene of early modernity, even the Middle Ages, we find that maxims appear as a kind of advisory literature. Maxims have multiple functions. One place that you would find maxims, and this is now moving into the bits about Bartholomaeus and Spinoza, one place that you find maxims are in encyclopedias and other kinds of advisory literature. Literature that, to use the old expression, the old Delphic proverb, is to help you know thyself, right? That imperative running all the way from Plato, who refers to it 5 or 6 times all over his works, on through Hobbes, on through Spinoza, I think, when you read the Ethics, and on through Kant. Now, encyclopedia, let's call this provisionally a medieval form, and I'll explain why I think that it is, though of course we know that encyclopedia is neither a medieval form, it's a classical form, and it's neither a Western form. There are versions of encyclopedia from the Ming Dynasty that run up to, make sure you hear this right, 11,000 volumes. That's extraordinary. And it's a shame that in the example I'm citing, only 400 volumes of this survive. Why encyclopedia matters and why this is something I want to talk about when I look at Spinoza in relationship to Bartholomaeus, and I am not sure whether that was evident that that's what I wanted to do when I gave you this assorted collection of readings. My point of departure is an observation by Leibniz, who says, when having heard about Spinoza's Ethics in their unpublished form, writes, quote, "Most people's philosophy starts with creatures. Descartes started with the mind. Spinoza starts with God." And that's the end of the quote. Starting with God. Spinoza's up to something, let's put it this way, okay? Starting with God is almost, in a way, hiding in plain sight. If you know the story about how a recent copy of the Latin version of the Ethics was found, it too was hiding in plain sight. It was in the Vatican Library, which we can recall would be a place where theological works, you know, especially in the Renaissance, were censored and approved. The cataloger and those who work on medieval manuscripts knows how this works. How many works are in a catalog of manuscripts are described just by the incipit, and then that's all you get, and you have to call up the manuscript and read what it says. But the cataloger described the work according to the first words of the heading, De Deo, on God, and took Spinoza's tract to be not a work of heresy, which would have no place in the Vatican Library, but a work of theology. It looked like an encyclopedia. It looked like any other garden variety work of philosophy and theology, and so there you have it, and that's how it was discovered, hiding in plain sight. My idea about what brings Bartholomaeus and Spinoza together is that Spinoza is using the encyclopedic form, and this is something that hasn't been discussed at all in the analysis of Spinoza. And I picked Bartholomaeus because, not for any direct influence, but because that's one of the most widely circulated encyclopedias of the Middle Ages, surviving into early modernity, printed in numerous editions, about 14 editions, so it would stands as a good example as any other. So both begin in God. If you look on the handout again, if you don't have it, just read the first words, where it says Book 1, De Deo, and concerning the names of God, and so on and so forth. And if you look at the table of contents for Spinoza's Ethics, which I have for you on the handout, we have Ethics, demonstrated in the geometric order and divided into 5 parts, which treat, part 1, of God. So they are both dealing with God. They are both titled, as it were, because this is the first page, De Deo. Now, Spinoza talks about substance. Bartholomaeus, if you looked at that reading, also talks about substance. Whereas Bartholomaeus wants to talk about the unity of substance, that is, the unity of substance, quote, not admitting division, but always in a unity of essence. Spinoza wants to talk about God as a single substance, who is the only substance in the natural world, or in any world for that matter, and who is a substance that is not divided into parts, but rather expressed in modes. A proper encyclopedic beginning in the Middle Ages would talk about God, talk about his substance, and talk about the unity of his substance, but make the qualification, as you always see, about his dispersal but non-divisibility among the divine persons. Vincent of Beauvais's great encyclopedia as well has a similar beginning. Starts in God, the mirror of nature. Starts in God, talks about the Trinity as the division of substances. And then we have Spinoza making his beginning, not offering a Trinitarian theology, but nonetheless and likewise making a beginning in God, talking about God as a substance, and then proceeding to talk about God as, quote, a substance consisting of an infinity of attributes, unquote. Spinoza tells us that, quote, substance is neither separated nor divided, unquote, and proposes that, quote, particular things are nothing but affections of God's attributes, or modes by which God's attributes are expressed in a certain and determinate way, end quote. Spinoza is doing what you do with an encyclopedic beginning. You begin at the beginning of everything, God, and then proceed to offer a series of what Hegel would call abstract determinations, which you can regard as distinctions without differences. It's the similar strategy of just saying three persons in one. That's abstract determination. Aquinas has a model of this as well. So Spinoza adopts the encyclopedic form and mirrors its movement from God to substance to the problem of divided but not distinct substance. And then if you looked at all the readings from Trevisa, which I couldn't possibly have expected you to look at, they're all in Middle English and they're extremely long. But if you just look at the table of contents of, in other words, Trevisa's translation of Bartholomaeus' encyclopedia, you will see that Bartholomaeus' encyclopedia is somewhat like the organization of Spinoza's ethics. So Spinoza turns in the second chapter to of the nature and origin of the human mind, and then to the third chapter of the origin and nature of the affects, which is a chapter about the body. So Spinoza's plan is to go from God to mind to body. Bearing in mind this organization of chapters, and Spinoza gives us two more, we can observe that Bartholomaeus, while writing a very different work, follows a similar plan. In his first chapter, he discusses God. In his third chapter, mind and soul. In the fourth chapter, body. God, mind, body. This is the order of proceeding as Spinoza saw fit, and his only formal difference from an encyclopedia like Bartholomaeus's is that he omits a chapter on the angels, which is Bartholomaeus's second chapter. And so Spinoza, again, I would argue, follows the form. He invents within the medieval encyclopedic frame and makes adjustments accordingly, such that his philosophy is, in its overall impact and conception, totally new but weirdly familiar. So my claim is that Spinoza's beginning in God would surprise an early modern philosopher like Leibniz, who might have forgotten what the very standard way of organizing an encyclopedia was in the Middle Ages. In that respect, it would be a surprise, but only to a surprise of someone who seeks to repress or occlude the Middle Ages. Now, there's more you can do here with this, and I want to move us along, and it's only to say that when you look at the table of contents, something else is signaled, the table of contents to the ethics, something else is indicated. The table of contents of God, of the nature and origin of the mind, 3, of the origin and nature of the affects, 4, of human bondage, or the powers of the affects. Chapter 4 deals with the passions and speaks of human bondage. And then immediately this brings to mind a tradition of writing on the passions from Galen's On the Passions and Errors of the Soul to Descartes' Passions of the Soul. You have an interesting coinage in Galen where he talks about being a slave to the passions, which is what basically Spinoza is doing when he says that, you know, this chapter is about the human bondage to the passions. There's more we can do with this tradition of the passions, because when you talk about the passions, you know we're talking about something else as well, which would be virtues and the virtues tradition. And so there's a second thread of literature that is relevant to Spinoza and which can be identified with a body of writing that has an encyclopedic function too in the ingathering of forms of maxims and advice called Fürstenspiegel writing, or mirror for princes writing, which is an advisory kind of literature that takes up the problems of the virtues and the passions to diagnose and cure the ailing mind or body of a particular prince. Now, the tradition here is signaled by works by Aquinas, the first part of the second part of the Summa Theologiae, Aegidius or Giles of Rome, De Regimini Principum, around the late 13th century. There is a work that has a continuator, Aquinas and Bartholomew of Lucca, on the same title, On the Rule of Princes. And these are works that talk about the virtues as a way of correcting passions that enslave a given individual. Virtues are what channel the passions. Virtues are what moderate the passions. Virtues are what you adopt to practice self-moderation and self-control. Okay. And the way that you do that is you adopt maxims. And when you read Spinoza's Ethics, and this is what's lost, on the one hand, because we're so used to thinking about its modernity and the geometric order of its demonstration, that we fail to realize that sometimes when we read or hear a definition, what in fact we are hearing and reading are maxims. If someone imagines that someone loves him and does not believe he has given any cause for this, he will love that person in return. Oh, you have no reason to love me? Well, then I love you back. Hate, completely conquered by love, passes into love. And the love is therefore greater than if hate had not preceded it. And there's lots of examples like this, and it feels like I'm in the self-help section of the bookstore. And so it's an interesting coincidence of what brings Spinoza and Kant together is this appeal to the maxim. Kant says, make up your own maxim, universalize it. Spinoza gives a series of maxims, which are called propositions. And when we see that they're labeled P55, P56, P57, proposition 55, 56, 57, we have our philosophical hat on, we're listening with our philosopher's ears and hearing propositions, when at that point in the ethics what we're hearing are maxims. And what Spinoza tells you to do at the very end of the ethics is to practice your maxims, recite them to yourselves. Whenever a bad thought arises or you are seized by a passion, throw a maxim on top of it. It's this kind of focalizing discourse of literary cultivation. And I think that you can only get that as the end of the ethics or as the solution to what ails the person in the ethics by an author who knows where this literature comes from and the genres and forms that are necessary for this kind of self-care and self-fashioning. And those come out of these advisory traditions that I've been talking about here. And so now then the question is, finally, is what do we do about this? If this is a question about literature and philosophy, then it seems to me it's really a question about genre. And I gave you the reading, the final reading in Jameson, as an example of what you might or might not be able to do with genre and the ways in which we can think of genre as either a mode, which in that way I take as just in a more epistemological sense, that a genre as a mode is a way of thinking versus a genre as a fixed form. And Jameson goes through the two options of looking at these things, genre as a mode, genre as a fixed form, okay? And it requires us to ask, do we do different kinds of work as critics or as scholars looking at the genres of literature and thinking about genres in relationship to literary history than we do as philosophers looking at genres in the history of philosophy? Does genre have the same determining force or presence in the shaping of a thought or the shaping of expression or the making of literature or in the making of philosophy? Where I end up, as you might expect, is in Hegel, because as I indicated at the very start, where I find theory is in the move from Hegel to Kant. What do you get in Hegel? But a work that adopts multiple genres. It includes romance. I gave you a bit of my book, The Birth of Theory. It includes Mirror for Princes writing. It includes drama. It includes an analysis of Antigone. It includes so much that you could call literature. And it is a work that at once tells a story. It's a Bildungsroman. It is a story of the movement of the concept or the story of the formation of the concept. Well, it's one hell of a story, and I don't think people read it for, you know, its historical content, but Hegel wrote it for that reason. And so where my interest in Hegelianism is, and in that move from something like Kant's Critique of Pure Reason to the Phenomenology of Spirit, is that at once philosophy is at once literature. Okay, thank you.